You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our Micro Learning podcast series titled Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Retinal Diseases to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. I'm Sharon Windsor-Harker, Medical Director of the Vision Relief Program with Med Learning Group. This is a five-part podcast addressing treatment in retinal disease. Today, we will be focusing on retinopathy of prematurity. Today's guest is Dr. Nemo Patel, Director of Pediatric Retina, Associate Fellowship Director at Massachusetts Eye and Ear and Massachusetts General Hospital, Director of Pediatric Retina Surgery at Boston Children's Hospital, and Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. Let's get started with today's episode. Hello, Dr. Patel. We're so thrilled to have you on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell me, what is retinopathy of prematurity and who is at risk?
So retinopathy of prematurity is my favorite condition to treat and manage. And part of the reasons for that is that it is preventable and it is treatable. Retinopathy of prematurity, it's a condition in the eye where too much oxygen during the neonatal period causes an arrested vesicle growth. Then subsequently, when the oxygen is pulled off, the vessels can grow abnormally, leading to bleeding and retinal detachment and subsequent vision loss. The major risk factors include low birth weight and low gestational age at birth. There are a variety of other risk factors that have been studied as well that play a secondary role. Prompt diagnosis and treatment are really important for this condition. And so there's a lot of research now undergoing into when to screen, who to screen, and how frequently to do so. Other things that we're looking at with retinopathy of prematurity is that there's an increased survival of premature and low birth weight infants worldwide and also within the United States. And this is actually causing an increase in retinopathy of prematurity because these very premature patients are requiring a lot of oxygen to survive, and they actually have pretty good systemic outcomes. But what's happening is then that's a higher burden of potential eye disease that we need to be able to manage and address. So our current high-level guidelines is we screen patients who are born 30 weeks or less and less than 1,500 grams. We start seeing them at 31 weeks or 4 weeks after birth, whichever is later. And we usually see them every 1 to 2 weeks worldwide.
Is the potential rise in ROP prevalence being adequately recognized in clinical practice?
Well, I think there's some significant gaps in education on retinopathy of prematurity that we can address. Number one, pediatric retina and pediatric ophthalmology in general are fields that we don't have enough doctors. There's a lot of areas of both the United States and worldwide where there are a lack of providers. Globally, there are some places that don't even have screening guidelines for ROP, and that wasn't as much of an issue prior, but now that these premature babies are surviving, it's leading to another wave or an epidemic of ROP globally, and this is also being mimicked in rural parts of the United States. So there is a rise in ROP prevalence and premature births, and we are going to need tools and management strategies to help improve healthcare access for these patients and make sure that we have enough treating physicians and avenues of being able to diagnose this condition that we can at least start to make some inroads there. The most important part of ROP is that it is actually preventable for the most part. There are some very severe cases that no matter what you do, things tend to progress. And some of those may be even associated with systemic genetic disorders. But true ROP and managed in a timely fashion is largely preventable. So if we can get these injections and these lasers done right away and we're screening the patients appropriately, we can actually prevent much of the vision loss that's being recorded. And ROP is one of the highest causes of global pediatric childhood blindness.
That's really encouraging to hear. But tell me, what are the main challenges with ROP right now?
I would say the number one is probably a lack of knowledge transfer. There's not a lot of training programs that allow for long-term evaluations of patients with ROP. The people who are really managing this condition are doing so and learning as we go along. And we're trying to improve this knowledge transfer through courses in the AAO. more so than in the United States, globally, there's even a bigger knowledge gap. So the question is how can we improve this? So some of the challenges are heterogeneity in neonatal care, leading to a variety of outcomes. Also a lack of data in some of these areas, so we don't know who's at most high risk. And that many of the guidelines are actually based on outdated data sets. I think some of the challenges are understanding who requires treatment and when. Some of these guidelines were made primarily when we had laser for a treatment. And laser is a good treatment and it works pretty well. The downside is that it's a little bit more destructive. There's more area that can be cause scarring. There's higher rates of inflammation. And even more than that, it can take a long time to administer and be difficult, and there can be a learning curve. Now that we have another option with injections, it could be that potentially patients who have more treatable disease can be done earlier. So instead of having to wait for patients who are going to progress, we can actually look for patients who are a little bit earlier stage and treat them then. But we don't have, again, much data on this, so we need more information.
Can you tell me more about these eye injections?
Yes. So thankfully, we've entered a new realm of treating retinopathy of prematurity, and I think there's a role for both laser and injections. The benefits of the injections is they're easy to administer. They're relatively safe with a very low infection rate. We quote less than 1 in 3,000 to 5,000. They can be done in the NICU without putting the patient to sleep. Oftentimes, if we are going to laser, we may have to put the patient back to sleep or reintubate the patient. And more than that, it also gives you some time. So the anti-VEGF injections, they actually start working right away, and then they tend to probably stay in the eye for at least a month or two. And so it can actually allow time for things to improve, the patient's overall systemic health to improve. The benefits of laser, it's a really more permanent treatment. The anti-VEGF can wear off eventually, and so the laser is a little bit more permanent. And let's say you're worried about the patient now exiting the NICU and having issues with follow-up, the laser may be a little bit better of an option. Probably the best treatment is some sort of combo therapy. So we did a study looking at practice patterns for retinopathy of prematurity and saw that a lot of doctors are using anti-VEGF up front to kind of get through that initial phase and ride out the storm, so to speak, let the vessels grow as much as possible, and then using laser as a prophylactic treatment to the remaining avascular retina to prevent future problems. A peak time for that is around 55 to 60 weeks. There's a few reasons for that. Number one is that that's when the baby gets a little bit hard to examine. So it's not a bad time to put them back under anesthesia, take one good look with angiography and laser the avascular retina. The other one is that might be right around the time the anti-VEGF therapy is starting to wear off. And number three, depending on your practice setting, oftentimes that's when the patient is a little bit more healthy from a systemic standpoint and may not have to stay overnight in the hospital. So that's, I think, probably the ideal treatment scenario for ROP is probably using anti-VEGF first. And then if there's remaining avascular retina, doing an exam under anesthesia and planning a laser therapy around that 60-week mark.
I see. Can you tell me what anti-VEGF therapies are available and how effective are they?
Yeah, so we learned from the BEAT-ROP study initially about bevacizumab for ROP, and that showed some good effects, especially for zone 1 or very posterior disease, that we could potentially have better outcomes. Thankfully, we now have other options that are FDA approved, and recently aflibercept 2 mg was approved based on the Butterfly and Firefly trials. And in that study, 80% achieved the absence of both active ROP and unfavorable structural outcomes at 52 weeks of age. And so there were, as expected, pretty favorable outcomes with this. The benefits of aflibercept 2 mg is that it is now FDA approved, but also it comes in a pre-filled syringe. And we just completed a study assessing in adult patients that vials or non-pre-filled syringes may be associated with a high risk of endophthalmitis and infection. The reason being, of course, more manipulation, more transfer of medication, more chance of contamination. This medication comes in a pre-filled syringe and can be stocked and then used without any higher risk of infection versus the bevacizumab, which may need to be compounded at your site. The other option is ranibizumab. This was used based on the RAINBOW study, where similarly, there were some good outcomes with this medication. However, one of our real-world studies using over 1,600 injections in 23 sites showed that compared to bevacizumab, ranibizumab actually had inferior outcomes in terms of retreatment. Some of the benefits, again, that it is a known approved medication, not for ROP, but it is approved in Europe for ROP, but not in the United States. Some of the benefits of this medication is the shorter half-life in terms of the lower molecular size. And the theory being that it can exit the eye a little bit faster than bevacizumab, and that may be leading to the more retreatments. However, if there's any concern about systemic risk, that may be mitigated by using the smaller molecule ranibizumab. With the caveat that up to this point, there really hasn't been any data suggesting negative neurodevelopmental outcomes from anti-VEGF. So at this point, we're not so worried about that. But those are the options that we currently have. There are other off-label anti-VEGFs, including faricimab and aflibercept 8 milligram that would likely be able to do just fine. However, I personally have not used them, and I haven't seen many reports at this stage.
How do you personalize therapy for your patients?
Yeah, and it's an area that we're starting to think about a little bit more is personalized therapy, not just in ROP, but other parts of medicine as well. And I think we're starting to look at specific risk factors on the birth weight, gestational age, and particularly these very low birth weight infants. So I'd say some of the personalization has come with treating these patients who may be higher risk, knowing that they're going to get worse at an earlier stage. And the other things that we're working on is actually personalizing ROP screening guidelines. So currently what we're doing is we're screening patients with essentially one guideline or not at all, and they're only being screened inpatient or not at all. And one of our big theories is actually across this whole ROP cohort, there are very different risk categories. There are some patients in a low-risk group that maybe only have a less than 1% chance of needing treatment, and there's a group that are high-risk that are over 50%. And I think one of our theories was that we could be more personalized. So I'd say personalization is happening both in treatment and then also as we look on a larger scale with screening guidelines, can we tailor these a little bit better to the actual patient?
How do you talk to patients' caregivers about the risks and benefits that are associated with laser and anti-VEGF therapy?
Yeah, this is one of the most difficult parts that we face. You know, ROP, we have difficulty understanding it even as specialists, and it's even harder to talk to patients about it. It's a very abstract thought about vessels in the eye and oxygen. So what I try to do is make it very, very simple and talk really about vision loss and no vision loss. And what we're doing is preventing vision loss. And I think if you start there, most people and most parents can really understand that. And talking to them that we're not improving vision, we're not stopping the need for glasses, we're preventing irreversible vision loss. And that kind of starts the conversation, especially when we're talking about treatment. When we're talking just about screening, we say, hey, there is a risk. I usually actually try to give them about a percentage chance that they may need treatment. So I say, okay, we're here to take a look at your baby's eyes. We're going to come back once a week. We're aiming to check for any issues in terms of the blood vessels in the eye. Good news, your baby was in the low risk category and has less than 1% chance of needing treatment. So I give them at least a ballpark to think about. And that way it does preempt them if treatment is required, especially for the high-risk patients. So, you know, if you tell them up front, hey, you have about a 25 to 50% chance of needing treatment, then when it gets closer, they've already started to think about it. And then maybe the next time you see the patient or the mother or the father, or any family member, you can start to talk more about the types of treatment and what maybe those risks and benefits are. So I try to not give them all the information at once, start very simple. And then as we get closer to the time, the specific treatments and what they are and the anti-VEGF, I think they do get a lot more comfortable knowing that these treatments are used all the time in other conditions. So I often do ROP rounds after my morning injection clinic, and I'll say, hey, we actually just did 40 of these injections this morning in our clinic for a variety of conditions. So I think it's helpful for them to know that, you know, this is not a very rare treatment. This is not a trial. This is something that's been done thousands and thousands of times all over the United States. So then I talk a little bit about that and how we're using it for other conditions with a similar aim of decreasing abnormal blood vessel growth. And then if the questions do come up about anti-VEGF and systemic disease, we talk about some of the studies. And similarly, the questions that we get about laser are actually more about the anesthesia, if you're going to go back under anesthesia for laser. And I will actually often say that, hey, I've not personally encountered any problems with this, but I do defer much of that to the anesthesiologist, because the anesthesiologists are also very comfortable with pediatric anesthesia. If we're talking about the anti-VEGF, I try to make them more comfortable by talking about how we have a long history of use in adult patients with other conditions, and actually that we do the injections awake and they usually don't feel pain. I think those are all parts that are helpful.
That's really encouraging. I mean, I can only imagine what those parents and caregivers are going through at that point in time as it is. Can you tell me what other challenges you face in your practice when treating patients with ROP?
Yes, I think, you know, my challenges that I face are probably fairly common amongst all doctors who screen and treat patients with ROP. I think one challenge is that there's not always many people who are doing it in the same area. And that makes you the on-call person sometimes 24/7 for this. So if you have a referring doctor from another NICU who wants to transfer a baby down, they may text or call you when you're on vacation or somewhere else. And you have to be somewhat available to take those calls. You have to have a contingency in place. And I think those are probably the main practice things. The injections have really helped in terms of the timing. One of the difficulties is that we're already busy retina specialists, and we may only carve out a certain portion of our day for ROP screening. And if you have a patient that requires a long laser therapy, putting back to sleep and things like this, it can be very difficult to schedule. And so having the anti-VEGF therapy come in and it being just a quick injection, it doesn't really add a lot of extra time to our screening. And that's been quite helpful. In terms of, you know, the challenges that we're all facing is, how do we screen the patients in local NICUs, or how can we get this expertise to other areas so that they don't have to transfer patients to us to screen and treat? Is there other ways to screen the patients, especially the low-risk patients? And that's kind of where we're going in the future.
It sounds like there's a lot of opportunity for doctors who are in med school to maybe find this subject of interest and learn more about it. Tell me, what do you see for the future of ROP management?
Yeah, one of the reasons that ROP is one of my favorite conditions is that there's still a lot of opportunity. We've gotten to a point where, for the most part, you can have good outcomes with timely diagnosis and management. However, even the timely diagnosis and management is a challenge, and that lends itself really well to telemedicine. It's a disease that you can look and at see. So if we have good technology with cameras, which we're starting to get, these cameras can then take photos and be sent to us remotely, and we can then screen many patients without physically having to go to these areas. And that's really the next frontier, and it's already here. We actually set up a telemedicine program in Wentworth Douglas Hospital in New Hampshire that's part of the Mass General Brigham hospital system. And we've had a really good experience with that, because prior, what was happening is these patients who are from 2-3 hours away are being transferred to us because they don't have ROP screening. Is that big of a deal? If you talk to the parents, it is, because their support system is locally. So some of them are coming back and forth that they want to be with their child. So being 2-4 hours away is a real issue. And not only that, it's a long time. So remember, we said we start screening at 30 weeks. So that can be over 2 months that the baby is away from the parents' house. And incorporating telemedicine has been great. It's also been useful from a kind of a financial or health system standpoint, where these local community NICUs with had lower acuity issues having to transfer the baby to the higher level NICU when we're already stressed from other conditions. And that patient outside of the RRP is actually much better served in the community hospital because they don't have as many medical diagnoses. So that helps them keep the baby at the local area and save the bed space at the high acuity tertiary center for those who really need it. So it's been really a win-win all around. Some of the limitations of telemedicine is that you do need a nurse to take the photos, and there can be some difficulties. It's not the easiest, and so there has to be some good training on this front. And some of the image quality can be variable, and you may have to retake photos. Globally, this is probably where we're headed, and we're trying to establish programs in Africa, South America, and trying to get expert graders to start to help them with who needs treatment and triaging patients. So telemedicine is here and definitely something that could solve the resource issue. Of course, AI is really good for this as well. So there has been some studies suggesting that AI can help you diagnose treatment word at ROP within 99-95% plus accuracy. Some of the limitations is that this may not be generalizable to all patients. They require potentially certain level of image quality or processing. But when you kind of put these things all together, there could be a better outcome. So we're not saying that, you know, stop using doctors to screen. What we're saying is that maybe you could have telemedicine. And I think the other future is really more local, regional, and global collaboration. We're starting to do this by gathering data from other countries. So there are some countries that have great ROP data that just have not had the resources or the time, the research fellows, to be able to analyze them. And so that's what we're doing at Harvard Massineer, is starting to gather this data, apply our screening algorithms to their data to see if this is something that can be done on a worldwide scale. Plus, as we talked about earlier, seeing who needs treatment and where are the patients getting missed, where are they going blind, and where do we need to then focus our efforts in education, even partnering with certain groups like Orbis to see if we can do global ophthalmology programs to help prevent these conditions from causing blindness worldwide.
Do you have any clinical pearls and recommendations for those treating ROP patients?
Yeah, I think the number one is if you happen to start, which a lot of people do. So it's always a little bit funny to me when we have residents and fellows who graduate with not much of an interest in retinopathy of prematurity. However, they only want to live in a certain city, and the practice that they join says, hey, we're screening ROP and you're the new person. We need you to screen ROP if you want a job here. And a lot of folks who didn't intend to screen ROP are now doing it. And I think the number one clinical pearl is to always ask for help if you're uncomfortable. So if there's a case that you're worried about, call me, call your other mentors. Just ask if you don't know. We'd rather have people err on the side of caution than miss a treatment case. And then I'd say, you know, maybe a little bit controversial, but I'd say err on the side of earlier treatment. I think the field is going to move in that direction. And if you're worried about a patient, the risks of the treatment are generally quite low. And, you know, a complication of blindness is a really negative outcome when the risk of a treatment is less than 1 in 5,000. So if you know, it's one of those things, if you think the risk of them getting blind is greater than that, you should probably consider treating.
Dr. Patel, I don't know if you're comfortable sharing your story about how you became interested in treating ROP.
My story is kind of a little bit by chance. I was accepted for residency at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute, and I was going to go down there early for a month and do some projects and research as part of my intern year. And one of my mentors, and she does pediatric retina and ROP, that was Dr. Audina Barakal. And so that's how we got connected at the very beginning. And then she was one of my key mentors. And when I started doing small projects with her in ROP and pediatric retina, found that even some of the very simple questions were not answered in the least. And it was very shocking to me. You know, in medicine, there's a lot of answers, there's a lot of research, even in ophthalmology. But in this area, there was still a lot to be learned, as we've talked about here. And I remember we had done one paper on practice patterns. Very simple, just, you know, what are you doing? Who are you treating? When? what needle size, how far back do you inject, these things. And I presented at a conference and I was getting all these questions after, and everybody was very excited about the work. And I said, wait, isn't this in a textbook somewhere? Or didn't you already know some of this information? And I found out the answer was no. And then we went from there and even started looking at comparative outcomes versus and the different types of anti-VEGF. Again, something I would have thought would have been well studied, but our study at that point was the largest real world study to date on that subject. And so I think that really kind of propelled me forward to take on more of this and say, well, you know, this is clearly an area of need and this is something that I'm interested in. And if I'm not going to do it, who's going to do it? And I still work with Dr. Barakal, who is the inspiration, and we do a lot of collaborative research projects, and I still call her if I need help.
That's fantastic. That really speaks to your point about, you know, not being afraid to ask for help from your mentors. I think that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Dr. Patel. This has been a very valuable discussion. Thank you for listening. Please join us again soon for our next episode in this series discussing diabetic retinopathy with Dr. Judy Kim. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. A special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity. Thanks for listening.